wrapped around his neck, and the head buried itself into his back. Even in such dire circumstances, Harold could never remember feeling so, what was the word, whole, like a part of him that had gone missing had finally found its way back. Harold slowly got his freezing hands to wrap around the rope, and centimeter by centimeter he began to reel himself in. He thought it might be easier to pull the truck from a pit of sand than to get himself and the girl from the icy pit. Then he felt the head nestled in his back lift. He heard teeth chattering, and in a shallow whisper, the small girl on his back said, "You saved me." In that second, he was already out of the water. He heaved and pulled and inched his way out of the water and crawled the 40 feet to safety. Then he turned, collapsed on the rocks, the tiny angel falling into his arms. I was on the edge of my seat, literally sitting on the last half inch of the small bench. I shook my head and said, "How long were you in the water?" He shook his head.
"I don't know. Less than a minute, but it felt like two forevers."
I thought about the freezing Puget, and that water had been 15 degrees warmer than what Harold was dealing with. And the girl, she was okay?
She was blue, and she kept saying, "Pickles." Pickles was the dog.
I'm guessing Pickles never barked again. I said, "What then?" "She was probably hypothermic." He nodded.
"I had some blankets in the car."
Harold returned with the blankets. The little girl was shivering. He gently lifted her up and wrapped the blankets around her. His mom had knitted the blankets, and they were both thick and warm. He massaged the thin body underneath. After a good 5 minutes of this, the small body stopped shivering. He noticed the girl's eyes were now open. He couldn't remember seeing anything quite like them. They were the color of the caramel his mother made at Christmas. Her teeth were still chattering, but he could have sworn he heard her say, "Thanks." Harold smiled. He lifted the small package, surprised at how light she was, probably no more than 80 pounds, and started toward the King Mansion. It was a quarter mile stretch to the enormous house. Harold could fit 30 of his small house within the large estate. Two cars were parked in the gravel courtyard. He had seen the cars driving on the road once or twice. He wasn't sure what kind of cars they were, but they looked awfully expensive. Black and shiny. Nothing like his father's rusted old Ford. Harold looked down at the small form in his arms. Her eyes were closed and she wasn't moving, but he could feel the rhythmic rise and fall of her small chest under the thick blankets. She was sleeping. He moved a large section of damp hair and kissed her lightly on the forehead. There was a large brass knocker attached to the door, and Harold lifted it and thrust it against the door twice. After a short time, the door was pulled open. A large black woman dressed in white stood staunchly in the foyer. She smiled warmly, was set to speak, then noticed the bundle in his arms. She said, "Miss Elizabeth." Harold looked down at the beautiful young girl. Elizabeth. The woman swiftly took the small girl from his arms and turned and ran. Harold didn't know what to do. This isn't how he had envisioned it. He had saved the young girl. Shouldn't he be praised for his courage? He was a hero, wasn't he? The door was left open. Harold could hear feet scampering around and faint yelling in the distance. He nearly turned to leave when he heard growing footsteps. A man appeared. He was a skinny man dressed in a suit with red suspenders. He had a large mustache and slick back hair. Harold found a knot had formed in his throat just at the sight of the man. He eyed Harold and yelled, "What did you do to my daughter?" Harold tried to speak, but words wouldn't come out. The man said, "You stupid, I asked you what you did to my daughter." Harold closed his eyes. He knew what he wanted to say, tell the man that he risked his life to save his precious daughter, but nothing came out. The man said briskly, "What's your name, boy?" Again, nothing. A woman appeared. She was cradling Elizabeth in her arms. Harold's old, ravaged blankets had been swapped out for expensive linens. Just the idea of having their daughter wrapped in homemade blankets horrified these people. The man reached his hand back and slapped Harold in the face. "I asked you what your name was, boy." Harold cringed. He focused and somehow managed, "Harold. Harold Humphreys." The man cocked his head.
"You the Humphreys boy from up the road?"
Yes, sir. We lease land from you.
75 acres, yes, I know. Your daddy was late on his payment this year. If he has another bad crop, you lose the land."
This irritated Harold. He wasn't sure if it was because he had just saved this man's daughter, and the man was talking about the money his father owed him, or because his father hadn't told him about their financial woes. And here Harold was, abandoning his father, when he truly needed him on the farm, and stealing his truck to do it. A wave of emotion flooded Harold. He nearly began to cry. He looked at his shoes to try and hide his tears. The man said, "Now I'm going to ask you one last time. What did you do to my girl?"
"He saved me."
Both Harold and the man looked at the girl. She locked eyes with Harold, unblinking. Harold's eyes welled with tears as he smiled at the perfect form. But then he was struck again by the man, a fierce blow. The man pushed and shoved him. He was yelling, "Get off my property, boy! Get, before I have you arrested!" Harold stumbled and fell. Arrested? But didn't he just learn that Harold had saved the girl? Harold pushed himself to his feet. He felt the tears streaming from his eyes. Why? Why was this man doing this to him? What had he done? He pushed himself off the ground and started running. He gave one last look back at the house. The man threw a rock at him and continued to yell. He could see the girl in the doorway, her eyes still locked on his. She lifted an arm from around her mother's neck and gave a slight wave. The woman wrinkled her nose, turned, and walked inside. Now I was off the bench, pacing in front of the small lake. I desperately wanted to find a time machine, go back to 1942 and kick the living shit out of this guy. Harold watched me silently. Finally, he asked,
"Are you okay?"
Yeah, but I wasn't. I'd had a similar experience with a girl's father. He wouldn't let her date me because I was a cop. I still thought about her on occasion, but not as often as I thought about shooting her father in the kneecap. I asked, "So what did you do?" He shrugged.
"What could I do? I ran to my truck, drove to the train station, joined the army a day later."
I leaned my head back and sighed. Then I turned and looked at Harold. He'd gone back to feeding the ducks. He threw a large piece of bread and two ducks jabbed at each other, until the bigger of the two choked down the large chunk. Harold shook his head and laughed. Chapter 14. By noon on Wednesday, I had the better part of the upstairs painted. I took a break at 1 and ate some lunch. PB&J, some Cheetos, a strawberry fruit roll-up, 3 Oreos, double stuff, of course, and a tall glass of milk. The perfect combination of protein, carbohydrates, partially hydrogenated vegetable oils, fruit pectin, red dye number 4, and processed sugar to fuel my second leg of painting. I just started back in. I was finishing up the trim work in Lacey's room when I heard a rather loud and highly annoying series of wind chimes. It took me a moment to register that it was the doorbell. Oh, how quickly we forget. I walked out of Lacey's room and across the hall to the guest bedroom. There was a window with white Venetian blinds, and I pushed one of the runners down with my finger. Droplets of water raced down the cold window, embossed over another gray Seattle afternoon. I didn't see a car parked in the slippery drive or one parked on the street. The chimes settled in for their encore, and I decided to wait them out. Your average person will give up after 2 rings. The chimes ended, and I waited to see who walked down the drive. Nobody. The chimes came back on stage a 3rd time, and then a 4th. I waited for the 5th set to mask my steps, then crept down the stairs and tiptoed to the door. I peered through the peephole, but it was black. Some shrewd individual had a finger over the lens. It was evident we were dealing with a pro here. I pulled the door open. Erica Frost was wearing faded blue jeans and a white hooded sweatshirt. Her hair was tucked behind her ears, and she could easily have passed for a student at one of the nearby colleges. I wasn't exactly sure why Erica Frost was standing on my doorstep. Was her visit personal or professional in nature? I had a feeling it was a combination of the two. Erica decided to clear this little matter up. She smiled and said, "You'll never guess who I got a call from yesterday. Ronald Reagan?" She cut her eyes at me. "Too soon?" She shook her head and said, "Adam Gray's lawyer." I attempted to keep a straight face while I pondered this. It never dawned on me Adam Gray would have a lawyer. I mean, they say that a man who represents himself as a fool for a client, but when you're the best criminal defense lawyer on the planet, you might want to do just that. And where exactly do lawyers go when they're in need of a lawyer? Do they just mosey on down the hall and knock on a buddy's door? "Hey, Chuck, how are you? How's that Murphy case going?" "Good, good. You see, Berta got kicked off Biggest Loser last night? Yeah, she half-assed her last chance workout. At least that's what Jillian said. Hey, listen, I sort of killed my wife. Do you think you could represent me? I shook from my reverie and asked, why? Are you in some legal trouble? No, I am not in any legal trouble. Actually, a man dropped in on Adam yesterday. Apparently, this man impersonated an FBI agent, asked some extremely sensitive questions, and was escorted out by security. That sounded like a fair assessment, although I didn't recall being escorted out. I said, and you're telling me this because...
Because the man described fit your description.
What? Devilishly handsome, charming to no end, and clever like an otter? She rolled her eyes. Actually, the secretary described the man as looking... She looked down at the pad in her hand and read, sort of like Matthew McConaughey, but after a horrible car accident.
Burn.
I know that guy. He lives in Sarasota. Happy hunting. Actually, I think it was you. I put my hand to my chest.
Me?
You. Why would I visit Adam Green? Adam Gray. Right. Why would I visit Adam Gray?
Boredom?
Curiosity? I don't know. Maybe you just wanted to see the guy for yourself. Maybe you saw the guy on TV and he pissed you off and you wanted to kick the shit out of him. I have no idea. This, of course, was true on all counts. On that note, I said, I saw you on TV. Erica reluctantly let me switch the subject to her. Did you now? You know the camera adds 10 pounds. She looked herself up and down and said, are you trying to tell me I looked fat? I didn't say you looked fat. I'm just saying skip a meal every once in a while. She didn't respond. In fact, she just stood there, no doubt visualizing kicking my testicles into my throat. I did some damage control. Who knows? It might have just been the lens. Maybe it was a fisheye. I should reiterate that Erica Frost didn't have an ounce of fat on her. I don't make a habit of calling fat people fat. They know they're fat, and they know I know they're fat. But if you're wondering why I was acting like such an unconscionable prick, let me explain. I was falling for Erica Frost, plain and simple. That ship had left the pier a long time ago. This scared me. This scared me more than all the death I'd come across in my lifetime. My brain, which I fully understand is slightly less evolved than your average primate, was screaming at me to push her away, and that's what I was doing. Erica took a deep breath and said, well, I should get going here. I have to go throw up my lunch. She took a couple steps backwards, then turned and said, as for what I said earlier, we'd appreciate if you stopped harassing our suspects. It's making it hard for us to conduct our investigation. Plus, Adam Gray isn't the guy to mess with. He's threatened a lawsuit against us and against you. I still don't know what you're talking about, but thanks for the heads up. She started down the drive. I stared upward at the ceiling for a couple seconds. I tend to do this before I do or say something incredibly foolish. This time would be no different. Erica was halfway to her car when I yelled, what are you doing the rest of the afternoon? She stopped and turned around. You mean after I go run 10 miles, weigh myself 30 times, and order a bottle of Trim Spa? I was starting to get the impression Erica Frost was sensitive about her weight. Maybe she'd been a porker in high school. Maybe she had a shirt that read Fatties Never Forget. I said, you look beautiful. She cocked her head. I reiterated, on TV, you look beautiful. Something weird happened to Erica's mouth, like she was trying to fight down a smile. I've only called a handful of women beautiful in my day, and nothing bad had ever come of it, at least in the short term. Long term was a completely different story. Lots of grief in the long term. In fact, if I had access to a time machine, I would have traveled back 10 seconds and shot myself in the face. Erica stood, her hands on her hips, weighing the pros and cons of forgiving Mr. Thomas Prescott. She took her hands off her hips. Forgiven. She said, why? What do you have in mind? I had a couple things in mind, but I was a class act. Well, not a class act, but an act of some sort. Do you want to stick around and help me paint? She puffed out her cheeks and looked at the ground. From my recollection, women do this before they do or say something incredibly foolish. This time would be no different. Chapter 15. I outfitted Erica in one of my dad's old shirts, then set her up with a roller and a paint tray. After about a minute of silent painting, I asked, so where did you grow up?
Michigan, just outside East Lansing.
And how was that?
All right, I guess. Normal. Whatever you want to call it.
What do your parents do?
Dad is a professor at Michigan State.
Mom teaches preschool. What does your dad teach?
Shakespeare.
Ah, the beard.
Bard. I thought it was beard.
No, Shakespeare had a beard, but he was referred to as the bard. I guess we'll just have to agree to disagree on this one. She exhaled deeply, then said, So try growing up with William Shakespeare as a third parent. Gets a little old after a while. My dad read me Macbeth for the first time when I was 2.
Woe is thee.
She recited, He's mad that trusts in the tameness of a wolf, a horse's health, a boy's love, or a whore's oath.
Tell me about it.
Hamlet?
King Lear.
Which is the one with Mel Gibson and Danny Glover? She rolled her eyes at me for some reason and said, How about you? Where did you grow up? I did a 360 and said, You're looking at it.
Right.
Actually, I can't believe this place is still standing. There used to be a few other homes not far from here, but they all slid into the water.
Really?
Really. She raised her eyebrows and said, I think we're safe. She didn't look like she believed me. After grasping the nearest door frame to confirm the house wasn't moving, she asked, And how was your childhood?
No complaints, at least from my end.
Any brothers or sisters?
One sister, Lacey.
And?
She did a rolling motion with her free hand.
And she's a girl.
I figured as much.
She was an accident, although my mother would never admit to it. They had her when I was 8.
So she's what, 35?
Zing.
Actually, she's 42. I exfoliate.
She laughed and said, Really? She's what, 23?
25.
Is she here?
In Washington, I mean?
She's working at an art gallery in France. I bragged about her painting, told a couple Lacey anecdotes, and played Thomas Prescott, M.D., for 10 solid minutes. I explained what multiple sclerosis is, what it does, how Lacey was diagnosed, and how the disease is treated. I finished with, The last time I talked to her, she said she was thinking about staying in France. I think Erica detected the angst in my voice. She asked, And if she does decide to stay, what then? This could have been a fishing question. Maybe someone looking into the future. Maybe someone doing some long-term planning. Maybe this was someone who wanted to stop writing her 5-year plans in pencil. Then again, maybe it was nothing. I'll move to France, and I would.
Really?
Sure. Compared to the French, I come across as a nice guy. She laughed. Time to change the subject. How about you, any siblings?
2 brothers.
And? I accompany this with the please tell me more head bob. She smiled. 1 a year younger and 1 3 years older. Paul, the younger one, is Mr. Outdoors. Rock climbing, kayaking, hiking, camping, skiing. He's saving up to climb Everest. I love him to death.
And the older one?
James is your typical firstborn. Thinks he has all the answers. Let's just say we don't see eye to eye. I haven't talked to him in more than 5 years. Evidently, Erica was good at holding grudges. 2 demerits.
What about your parents?
How often do you talk to them?
She cringed.
3 times a year, like clockwork. Christmas, Easter, and on my birthday. I haven't been back to Michigan in 3 years. She switched things back to me.
What about you?
When's the last time you saw your folks?
A little over 8 years.
8 years? Is there a rift between you?
If you can count a pulse as a rift.
She turned. All the color had drained from her face, her gigantic faux pas sinking in. My parents died in a plane crash 8 years ago.
I'm sorry, I mean, I should have known. I mean, this is their house and oh my God.
It's okay. I went on to narrate the last couple hours of my parents' life. Rolling Stones concert in California, coming back in my dad's company jet, engine failure, crash landing in the Sierra Nevadas, no survivors. After the funeral, Lacey and I both left. Lacey had just graduated from high school and was headed to Temple, and I didn't have a job, seeing as I was let go from the force. A week after the funeral, we looked at each other, packed up, and left. 3 days later, we were sharing a 2-bedroom loft in Philadelphia.
How did you keep busy?
A guy I went to college with was a lieutenant in Philly. He found out I was living in town and asked me for my input on a case every so often. Then he started coming to me with every case. Then I started taking 3, sometimes 10-day contracts. Couple serial killers, couple cold cases. The feds got wind of some of my triumphs, and next thing I know, I've gone from working with angry Italians to working with tight-assed, tight-lipped wasps.
So it was basically the blind following the deaf, dumb, and blind.
More or less.
She cocked her head to the side and said, That's why your name sounds familiar. Weren't you involved in that case up in Maine about a year ago?
The maniac, I think they were calling him. If by involved you mean was shot, nearly killed by, then yeah, I guess you could say I was involved. She raised her eyebrows. I pulled the collar of my shirt down to expose my left shoulder. A patch of dimpled scar tissue there resembled the bottom of a cork. I said, another one just like him on my right thigh. No wonder you're retired. I wasn't sure if she was being sincere or goading me. With this small break in the conversation, Erica dipped her roller and started on a new section. Then she said over her shoulder, so you ever been married? Only a matter of time. Nope, I got close once. She, of course, ended up in 30 pieces with her eyes nailed to a wall. It would have been a messy wedding. I kept this to myself. It didn't work out. She said I was premature. Are you sure you don't mean immature? That too. She shook her head and laughed. It was gut-wrenchingly cute. How about you? You ever get hitched? Nope. Ever come close? She shook her head, and I said, clock ticking. You're worse than my mother. We had a conversation standstill, so I started in a new direction. How about you bring me up to speed on the Ellen Gray case? She didn't respond. She just continued painting. After about 10 furtive glances and 5 or 6 applications of paint to a roller, she gave. She turned and said, you know I shouldn't be telling you any of this. I was tempted to point out she was yet to tell me anything, but I didn't want our first fight to be over semantics. She took a deep breath and said, we're picking him up tomorrow. I assumed she was referring to Adam Gray. Tomorrow? She nodded and said, Ethan is at the courthouse getting an arrest warrant as we speak. What changed? Last I'd heard, which was directly from the lion's mouth, they didn't have anything to hold him on, least of all charge him with murder. We found Adam Gray's yacht. You found the habeas corpus? Erica froze. How did you know the name of his yacht? I took a deep breath and said, I was flipping through Forbes magazine and they had a write-up about him. They mentioned the yacht. What I failed to mention was that I was flipping through the magazine while sitting in Adam Gray's waiting room, just before I broke into his office and later interrogated him. I should also mention that I was toying with the idea of telling Erica about the blood I'd found on the underside of the cushions, but it would appear they already had enough against him, not to mention that this information would place me in Gray's office. I kept quiet. Erica eyed me but appeared to buy it. She continued, we'd searched practically every shipyard, port, and slip this side of the Everglades, but Gray's yacht was MIA. Then yesterday we get a call from a guy in Edmonds. He'd been on vacation for the last 3 weeks. Comes home and finds a yacht tied up to his dock. He takes a quick peek and notices a couple puddles of pink water on the deck that could have been blood. So he called the cops. I remember Adam saying something about having a house somewhere in Edmonds. I wondered if Erica was working with the same information packet as me. I said, I read somewhere that Gray is a place up that way. Just 3 houses from where we found the boat. You guys didn't think to check that area? We checked his property, of course, and we did a spot check on a couple neighbors. Somehow it slipped through the cracks. So you got a warrant? We didn't need a warrant because the blood was in plain view. Let me guess, you found a gun. She smiled. A recently fired .32. And the blood? The DNA on the deck was inconclusive. Something to do with the salt water, but it was female and type AB. AB was the rarest blood type. This wasn't nearly as concrete as DNA evidence, but it was enough that a judge would allow it to be entered as evidence. She was holding back, and I gave her a look. She said, we found traces of Ellen Gray's blood on a washcloth in the galley. This, of course, was conclusive. What about prints? Adam Gray's prints were on the gun. What about the boat? We lifted 3 sets, 2 male, Adam Gray's and one of his clients. This would corroborate Gray's alibi for the day Ellen went missing. Who was the third? Not sure, but they were female. They weren't from Ellen Gray, and they weren't in the system. So Adam did have a woman on the side. Erica said, we had some of our computer geeks hack into his navigational system. Records everywhere the boat goes on GPS. Let me guess. Adam took a late-night trip in a Puget Sound leading up to Thanksgiving. 4 days before, actually. That would make it Sunday. When, if you believed Adam, and I was starting to have my doubts that I did, he had been drugged and his keys were stolen. I couldn't comment on this, being that I had never met Adam Gray. Erica went on. He took the yacht out at 11:25 a.m., drove about 70 miles out into the middle of the sound, stopped for exactly 2 minutes, then at 3:17 a.m., drove the boat to where we found it in Edmonds. a textbook timeline for the disposal of a body. On paper, this was what you call an airtight case. Although, if this had been my case, I would have been contemplating the following questions. Why would Adam Gray, who was an absolute perfectionist, plan such a sloppy murder? Why hide the gun when you could just throw it overboard? Why not wear gloves and risk leaving fingerprints? Why leave the bloody cloth in the galley? And why leave the yacht tied 3 houses from a property you own? Adam Gray didn't get to where he was by making mistakes, but according to Erica, he made 4 biggies. You make 4 mistakes in a big court case and you're toast. End up with your client strapped to a chair with a needle in his arm. I surveyed Erica. I was wondering if the same questions were running through her head. Was she a skeptic? I hoped so. We painted for another 20 minutes before Erica's cell went off. She left the room for a couple minutes. When she came back, she was holding the shirt I'd given her. She handed it to me and said, "That was Ethan. There's a problem with the arrest warrant. The judge won't sign it. Turns out Gray went to school with one of his cousins or something." It didn't surprise me that Gray had a judge in his pocket. He probably had many. Adam Gray was one powerful man. Forbes might have him listed at 97, but he was number 1 when it came to his home turf. Even though this particular judge might not have signed the arrest warrant, eventually a judge would. There was too much evidence, an overwhelming amount. Still, I'd always thought of evidence like a bell curve. Too little or too much, and you needed to reevaluate the case. Erica's phone rang a second time, and she had a 30-second conversation. She flipped the phone shut and said, "Ethan found a judge to sign the arrest warrant, but not until Friday. The judge doesn't want the Proctor case to go to mistrial. They're giving their final summations tomorrow." I nodded. I walked Erica to the door. I wasn't sure if I was supposed to shake hands with her, give her a hug, or give her $100 for her labor. I told her I'd be in touch. I had her card. I opened the door for her, and she started down the drive. She took 2 steps, then turned. "Oh, by the way, Gray's lawyer sent over the security tapes from Monday." "Security tapes?" She said, "You sleep with your eyes open. It's kind of creepy." "I'll remember that next time I take a nap on camera." She turned and started down the drive. When she was about halfway, I said, "He didn't do it." She turned around. She just stared at me for a long minute, a 1,000-yard stare. Finally, she said, "Then who did?" "I don't know, but I was going to find out." Chapter 16. The Seattle Municipal Courthouse was located in the heart of downtown Seattle. I parked in the Space Needle parking lot and walked the 3 blocks west to the courthouse. The pervasive rain was unable to deter the protesters from showing up. Close to 100 people congregated near a series of barricades girdling the courthouse's stone steps. Most were decked out in ponchos and holding some sort of sign. I tapped a man wearing a bright blue poncho on the shoulder and asked him about the case. He said a guy named Proctor was accused of strangling a young black prostitute. Now, Seattle is one of the more liberated and liberal cities in the United States, and the fact that the girl was black wasn't an issue for the protesters. But Adam Gray had made a career of getting these deviants off without a slap on the wrist, and it was beginning to upset some folks. I read a couple of the ink-blurred placards as I skirted around the melee. "No OJ for Adam Gray." Another was more direct. "Proctor? Gray? Who cares? Kill them both." "Well put." Camera crews hovered around, and I saw a handful of reporters readying themselves to go live for the noon editions. I slipped past one of the barricades and started up the stone steps. I didn't expect to just waltz into the courtroom. I had concocted a little tall tale for the occasion. Stepbrother of the accused. 2 cops stopped me as I approached, and I fed them my line. They sneered at me, but let me through. I pushed through the large doors and into a feeding frenzy. The foyer of the courthouse was packed with more cameramen, more reporters. The combination of the high-profile Proctor case, Gray as his counsel, and also as suspect numero uno in his wife's death was too much for the media. It was one big clusterfuck. I tapped a well-dressed woman on the shoulder and said, "Do you know what's going on in there?" "Prosecution just rested. Recess until 12:30, then summations." She added, "They're not letting anyone else in. I heard there's a viewing room in the east wing." I nodded my thanks, then made my way to the courtroom doors. The bailiff gave me once over and said, "We're filled to capacity. There's an extra viewing room set up in the east wing." I think this may have been the woman's source of information, but I wasn't positive. I said, "I'm brother of the accused. I flew in from the Netherlands to be here." He raised his eyebrows. "The Netherlands?" "Sure, why not?"
Yep. He looked from side to side, then opened the door and ushered me in before anyone saw. It was standing room only. I wiggled my way through until I had a spot up against the far left wall. It was a large courtroom. The jury box was on my side. 12 empty seats. The gallery was 20 rows of seats filled to capacity. Both the prosecution and the defense tables were empty. No doubt both sides were getting their ducks in a row for their final summations. I'd only been inside a courtroom a handful of times. I had to testify twice in official investigations, and there had been three or four times when I'd been involved in a case and stopped in to watch the action. Speaking of which, I can make out Erica and Ethan sitting in the third row behind the prosecution table. I wondered how they got such good seats. Did they fandangle? Anyhow, 10 minutes later, the prosecution team rolled in. Four of them, all dressed sharply. The lead prosecutor was a balding man of about 50 with circular spectacles, sort of a middle-aged Harry Potter. All chatter stopped abruptly as they walked in and sat. The defense came next. It was just Adam Gray and his client. I recognized the defendant. I hadn't put it together until now. Proctor was in actuality Daniel Proctor. Daniel Proctor was a couple years younger than me, a decent-looking guy, compliments of an excellent plastic surgeon, with dark eyes and jet-black hair. He reminded me of that really snaky Baldwin brother, William, I think. Daniel and I had crossed paths 8 years earlier. He'd been my last arrest. In fact, the last time I'd seen Mr. Proctor, he'd been connected to all sorts of tubes, and his face had been swollen shut. The last time he'd seen me had been 12 hours prior to this, when I'd stripped him of all his clothes and repeatedly smashed my fist into his face. This, of course, led to my immediate dismissal from the Seattle Police Department and Proctor suing the city for $7 million, which he would go on to win. The jury was let in, and a moment later the judge entered. Everyone stood, then sat. I didn't recognize the judge, but he was a strict old codger. Within a couple of short minutes, the district attorney was out of his seat and delivering his summation. Harry Potter was a tad long-winded, but he was good. The state had about as solid a case as I'd ever heard, cut and dry. Proctor picked up the girl, took her to a shitty motel, had sex with her, strangled her, then threw her in a dumpster. They had his semen, her blood, his blood, one witness who saw him pick her up, the motel manager who saw him enter the motel with the girl, and a third who saw him exit without the girl. This wasn't exactly the grassy knoll. After the prosecution rested, I'd say everyone in the courtroom was convinced Mr. Proctor was a killer, and I didn't think there was anything Adam Gray could say to convince me otherwise. I was wrong. The judge nodded at Gray that it was time for his closing statement. He whispered into his client's ear, then stood. A hush fell over an already hushed crowd. Gray brushed a couple stray pieces of lint from his arms. He walked in front of the jury and locked eyes with each person for a brief moment. Two jurors had to look away. Gray's piercing green eyes simply too much. After a long minute, the judge had had enough. "Please proceed, counsel." Gray gave him a dismissive glance. This was Gray's courtroom, and everyone, including the judge, knew this. He would proceed at his own pace. He turned his gaze to the prosecution, stopping in front of each of the four attorneys. It was the definition of smug, and I found myself smiling, rooting for the asshole. Gray turned to the gallery. He swept his gaze over the family of the accused, then the family of the victim. He locked eyes with Erica and Ethan. I wondered if he knew they would be arresting him sometime in the next 24 hours. If he did, he didn't show it. He then gave one last look around the courtroom. He swept his eyes past me, then snapped them back. I offered a soft wink. "Guess who?" He took a deep breath but continued to stare me down. After 10 seconds, everyone in the courthouse began craning their necks to see who he was looking at. Soon every eyeball in the large courtroom was trained on yours truly. So much for anonymity. Gray's client, Daniel Proctor, sneered at me. I guess some of his long-term memory had come back. I thought I detected the faintest of smiles flash across his thin lips, but he turned before I could be sure. Anyhow, after another long second, Gray turned and faced the jury. I gave a quick look in Erica Frost's direction. She gave me a tiny wave with her fingers. Ethan shook his head at me, then faced forward. Gray coughed into his hand. It was showtime. The crowd collectively leaned forward as Gray said, "Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my client is a murderer."
Everyone gasped, including his client. Gray pointed at Proctor and said, "That man, sitting right there, has killed before. And if he walks out of here a free man today, he will kill again." Proctor was out of his seat. I'm quite certain he didn't know his attorney would be playing the murderer angle. Proctor screamed at his attorney, "I'm going to kill you first, you stupid son of a bitch!" Adam smiled and said to the jury, "See what I mean?" There was a bit of uncomfortable laughter from the gallery. Even a couple jurors cracked smiles. The prosecution was grinning ear to ear. The bailiff got Proctor under control, and Gray continued as if nothing had occurred. "But, ladies and gentlemen, there is one small problem." He paused, stared at his client, and said, "No matter what you think of my client, no matter how many women he's killed in the past, or how many women he will kill in the future, you can't hold this against him. The law will not allow it. Because when my client left Amanda Peters that night, she was alive. Sure, she was a bit banged up, but she was still very much alive." Proctor gave his counsel a cockeyed look. Gray went on for a short 10 minutes. He quickly discredited all three witnesses. The witness who saw him pick up the girl was in a liquor store across the street and had himself a bad case of cataracts. The manager, who was the most important witness, had been swigging on a bottle of Angry Times whiskey. They found it in the trash can during his shift and had a blood alcohol level of 0.18 when they questioned him 6 hours later. And the final witness, the witness who testified, she saw the accused leave the motel alone at 3:30 in the morning, was a prostitute herself. And if this wasn't enough, she had a little crack problem. Gray shook his head and said, "The medical examiner concluded the victim died by asphyxiation less than 6 hours before she was found, putting her time of death at 3 in the morning, which is all fine and dandy, except my client's car went through a toll booth 30 miles away, heading in the opposite direction at just after midnight." The jury, of course, knew all these details, but for most of the spectators, these details were fresh. People in the gallery jabbed one another and whispered. Gray said, "Traces of my client's semen were found inside the victim, but so was that of 3 other gentlemen. Who's to say there wasn't another fellow after my client? Or 2? Or all 3? We don't know these things, and we never will." A black woman stood and cried, "He killed her! He killed my baby!" The judge slammed down his gavel and said, "I will not allow outbursts in this courtroom." The woman shrank back into her seat. Gray looked at the woman and said, "I'm sorry for your loss, truly, I am. But my client did not kill your daughter. Somebody did. Maybe someday we will find him." Gray turned back to the jury. He went on to narrate how the Seattle Police Department had made mistake after mistake while gathering the evidence, and if they had only widened the suspect pool beyond his client, they may have found out who had committed this horrible, irrefutable, ungodly crime. Adam walked to the defense table, and the judge said, "Will that be all, counsel?" Adam took a sip of water, shook his head, and said, "No." He cocked his head to the side, took a deep inhale through his nose, and turned to face the gallery. There was something majestic about the way he held himself, as if he were a black hole sucking in the gaze of everything around him. Again, he swept his eyes over the collective audience, and again his eyes settled on me. He said, almost as if he was talking to me and me alone, "The system is corrupt. It is. We live in a country governed by laws written hundreds of years ago. We look to a constitution that has remained unchanged for nearly 2 centuries. It states that all men deserve a fair trial. But do they really? Does every man deserve a fair trial? Does my client, a playboy with an unlimited supply of the city's money, who has never worked an honest day in his life, a man who has hurt, killed, and God knows what else, does he deserve a fair trial?" Adam shook his head. "Surely he does not. He deserves to have his face beat in. Scum like him doesn't deserve a jail cell. He deserves to feel all the pain and suffering he's caused in his lifetime. Really, he deserves to die." The audience jeered, and a handful of people even started clapping. Proctor was gritting his teeth. The bailiff eyed him to stay put. The judge banged his gavel and said, "I don't know where you're going with this counsel, but please tread lightly." He turned his gaze to the gallery. "And if I hear so much as a peep from any of you spectators, you will be removed from my courtroom." Gray continued unfazed. "And don't get me started on a fair trial. There is nothing fair about this trial. This case has always been stacked in my client's favor." He walked to the prosecution table and said, "These four attorneys did an amazing job, really. They are hard-working lawyers working for slave wages who have been working tirelessly for the past 3 months to put my client behind bars." The prosecution team didn't appear to know how to take the praise, and all four appeared markedly uncomfortable. Harry Potter stood and said, "I object, Your Honor." The judge laughed and said, "On what grounds? That you were given a compliment? Sit down, counsel." He sat. Gray continued, "But they had little to work with. Three witnesses that could hardly be considered reliable. Two detectives that mishandled evidence at every step of the investigation. And most importantly, they had me." Everyone in the courtroom was shaking their heads, and from what I could see, most were fighting down smiles. "I'm expensive. I'm expensive because I'm the best. Had my client been guilty, had my client killed that young woman, would I still have taken the case? You're damn right I would have, and I would have gotten him off just the same." I looked down at my arms. I had chills. Adam said, "But when my client looks into my eyes, after telling me about all the pain and suffering and death, yes, death, he's caused in the past, and swears to high hell that when he left that girl, she was a bit bruised, but very much alive, well, I believe him." He turned to the jury and said, "Hopefully, someday they can tie my client to one of his horrendous crimes and put him away for a long time. In fact, I hope they sentence him to death. I really do. But today, he is charged with the murder of Amanda Peters. A murder he didn't commit." He walked up to the jury box, placed his hands on the railing and said, "He didn't do it. He didn't kill Amanda Peters. Someone else did. And for this very reason, you have to find my client not guilty." He added, "It's your duty." The jury recessed for 26 minutes before returning a verdict of not guilty. The gallery, reconvened quickly from the courthouse hallways, collectively gasped. Proctor let out a long sigh, then turned to shake hands with his lawyer, but Gray was already on his way out. He threw a quick glance in my direction, a look similar to the one MJ threw Spike Lee at the Garden after he put up 63. And I, much like Spike Lee, nodded in respect. The courtroom emptied, and I followed the herd until I was in the courtroom foyer. I was making for the exit when I felt a tug on my shirt sleeve. I turned. It was Ethan. Erica was at his side. Ethan said, "You're still the same little punk you were 8 years ago, Prescott. I told you to stay away from this case." "I was here clearing up a traffic violation. I was doing 260 in a school zone." He glared. "If I see you again, just see you, I'm gonna have you arrested." He stormed off. Something about the way he said it made me not doubt him. Erica leaned in and said, "What'd you think about Gray's little performance?" I told her it was quite impressive. She concurred. She smiled and said, "Still think he didn't do it? It doesn't matter what I think." "You're right. It doesn't." She winked at me and followed after Ethan. Chapter 17. I know very little about politics. In fact, I'd go so far as to say that I know absolutely nothing about politics. Hell, the last time I voted, it was for Carrie Underwood. So about the time Adam Gray was being hauled away by Ethan, Erica, and company, I was in Olympia trying to find a parking spot on Capitol Hill. If I was going to find out more about Ellen Gray, I thought this the best place to start. I should mention that I looked slightly presentable. I'd shaved, threw on a pair of my dad's jeans and a light blue button-down. I think the style was in J. Crew's Detective Chic. Anyhow, I covered my head and ran through the torrential downpour. It wasn't coming down in sheets, it was coming down in comforters. I'd said that to Alex once. She didn't laugh, and she did break up with me 3 days later. Coincidence? Maybe not. The streets were lined with school buses, and it dawned on me that the only time I'd been inside the Capitol building was in fourth grade. As for the building, it looked like the White House's ugly step-cousin. It was gray concrete, and although they might use different jargon in Architectural Digest, I describe it as columny. The compulsory steeple dome was there, as well as the American flag and Washington state flag. Throw in a couple hard-working state employees clambering down the stone steps, and you've got yourself a Norman Rockwell painting. I trudged up the 30 or so steps and pushed through the large double doors. I walked to the standard information booth, where a white-haired lady sat behind a high desk. She had the glasses with the necklace, and she looked like she should be in the enormous library across the street. She had a name tag that read Millie. Millie said,
"Help you?"
Her voice took me off guard. It sounded like that of a child, sweet and buttery. I said, "Hi, I have a couple stupid questions for you." She smiled, revealing perfect pink gums and flawless teeth. I guessed she used Efferdent and not the generic. Anyhow, she remarked,
"I'm sure they're not stupid questions."
"Au contraire." I said, "What exactly is a governor?" She gave a look as if to say, "You're right, that is a stupid question," then said,
"I'm not sure I understand the question."
That made two of us. I tried again. "What is a governor in charge of?"
"Oh, well, that's not that stupid."
She sat on the word "that" like it was her favorite porch lounger. I smiled. She took her glasses off and let them hang around her neck.
"The governor is in charge of the state, making sure the state runs smoothly."
"And how long is a governor's term?"
4 years per term, up to 2 terms, just like the president.
"And who does the governor spend the most time with?" She furrowed her brow and I clarified. "I mean, who is the governor closest with, people-wise?"
"Oh, it differs. When a new governor is elected, they bring in their own cabinet."
Apparently, I looked confused. She said,
"You do know what a cabinet is, don't you?"
"Sure, I put my groceries in them. In fact, I'm thinking of having mine redone." For the record, I knew what a cabinet was. And to come clean here, I knew the basics of what a governor did. But when people think you are incompetent and a tad slow, they tell you things they wouldn't tell the average person. Just look at Araldo. He made a career out of it. She pushed her glasses up.
"A cabinet is basically an elected official's team. Think of the governor as the coach and the cabinet as the players."
I nodded my understanding. "Just out of curiosity, who is the present governor?" Her eyes immediately glazed over. She said,
"Well, the acting governor is Bill Eggers. He took over about 2 weeks ago. He won't officially be governor until the first of the year. Unfortunately, the real governor was killed. Her name was Ellen Gray."
I nodded and said, "Oh," like I'd caught it on the news recently. After a moment, I asked, "Who was she closest with? Who did she confide in?"
"Her press secretary, Kim. Kim Holloway."
Bingo. "Does she still work here?"
"Not a her, it's a him, and yes, he's still around. One of the few that survived the changing of the guard."
She inched up in her chair, gave a small nod, and said,
"In fact, that's him right there."
I looked over my shoulder. A tall gentleman was strolling into the cafe attached to the back of the building. He had one of those BlackBerry things in his hand and one of those wireless things in his ear. The ones where, from one side, you looked like a cyborg, and from the other side, you looked like he'd just escaped the asylum. Millie smiled and said,
"If you hurry, you can catch him."
I gave a wry smile, turned, and followed after Kim Holloway.
Chapter 18. The Capitol Bistro was half coffee shop, half restaurant, half retail shop, and half asleep. Kim had opted for the coffee and sandwich bar, and I fell into line 3 people behind him. He was clad in a business suit with a pink dress shirt and complimentary pink striped tie. It takes a rare specimen to be able to pull off the pink ensemble, and Kim did it flawlessly. He had thick black hair with some of that pomade stuff in it, designer glasses, and the aforementioned metal earwig. I'd put him in his mid to late 30s. He ordered a wrap of sorts and a complicated beverage, then found a seat at a table near the window. I ordered a piece of banana bread and some apple cider. Kim was playing with his BlackBerry when I approached. The drab Seattle day pressed hard against the bistro's glass walls, and condensation had built up between the layers of the double-paned window. I stood behind the chair opposite Kim and waited for him to acknowledge me. He had one of those touchscreen BlackBerries, and he did a couple finger jabs before finally looking up.
He had light blue eyes with long eyelashes. Girls would kill for these lashes. I motioned to the seat with my apple cider and said, "Do you mind?" It was immediately evident he minded. He said, "Actually, I'm expecting someone." "Great, I'll leave when they get here," I said. He looked around the restaurant, then said, "There are plenty of open tables." I ignored him. I popped a chunk of banana bread in my mouth and garbled, "Nice tie." He looked down.
"Thanks."
"It's pink."
"It is."
"So is your shirt." He nodded. "Bright pink."
"You're a keen observer of color."
I shrugged and said, "It's a gift." I added, "I could never wear pink, but it looks good on you." He glanced down once. "Thanks, I guess." I popped another chunk of banana bread and took a long swig of apple cider. Kim had gone back to his BlackBerry. He was probably writing a memo to himself to avoid wearing pink so as to stop getting hit on by strange men. I tossed back my last chunk of banana bread, wiped my hands, and said, "Word is you were Ellen Gray's press secretary." He looked up. "Maybe I was." "Well, you either were or you weren't. Which is it?"
"Depends on who's asking."
"I am."
"And who are you?"
"I'm me." I don't think Kim was in the mood for my Abbott and Costello routine. He started to gather his stuff and I said, "Hold on." I told him how I'd been the one to pull her from the surf. He asked to see my ID and I suppose he found it satisfactory because he started yammering away.
"I've already told the police everything I know. They came looking for me a couple days after she went missing and put me through the ringer. I was one of the few people that knew where she'd been that Sunday."
"Hiking?"
"Yeah, other than me and the guy who heads up her security detail, and maybe her husband. She never told anybody when she went hiking."
"Describe the guy you talked to."
"Big guy, curly blonde hair, not quite as good looking as you, but close."
I gave him a look.
"Yeah, I am."
I mentally shrugged. What did I care if this guy let to go mano a mano? I said, "So they say you two are close."
"Who?"
"You and Sir Elton. You and Ellen." "I suppose we were.
I think she was drawn to me because I was the first guy in her life that didn't want to get into her pants. I mean, how many guys can you have sex in the city night with?"
"Not many." I explained to him I thought her death might be tied to her job. I asked him what her last couple motions had been as governor. He said, "Well, as anyone who lives here knows, the freeway system is a nightmare." I was tempted to tell him at one point today I went negative 10 feet in 47 minutes. I let him continue. "She wanted to institute a tax on all alcohol, tobacco, and firearms that would go directly to reconstruction of the freeway system. It would raise close to $10 million annually. It's actually in the last stages of legislation. Should be on the docket come next session. Looks like it will pass, no problem." That would have angered a decent number of people. One out of three drink alcohol. One out of five use some sort of tobacco product. One out of 10 own a firearm. But would anyone go so far as to murder for a 2-cent tax increase? I guess I'd have to take a straw poll at the next NASCAR race. I asked, "Anything else?" He told me about a couple of her highest priorities. Basically, all your standard stuff, the big five. Education, environment, crime, water, and transportation, among others. I wasn't exactly sure what a press secretary was in charge of, and Kim spent the next couple minutes titillating me with the intricacies of his job. Basically, he was in charge of making sure Ellen Gray said all the right things at all the right times. Sounded fun. I asked, "So do you have any suspects?"
"You mean besides that asshole she married?"
"Yes, besides him."
"No. Everybody adored Ellen."
"No threats?"
"None. At least nothing that got back to me."
"She was a celebrity, and she was beautiful. There had to be a couple nutjobs who were in love with her."
"Oh, there was the occasional love letter. A couple that got a little creepy, but nothing we ever took seriously."
"What about stuff related to work? She had to piss off someone. What's the cliche? It's harder to fit half a camel through the eye of a needle than to teach a man to fish all day." I added, "Carpe diem." He looked at the table, then looked up.
"Promise me you'll never say that again."
I promised.
He said, "I think the cliche you're thinking of is more like, you can only please some of the people some of the time."
I pointed at him and winked. "That's the one." Although I probably shouldn't have winked, leading the poor guy on and all.
Ellen alienated her fair share of people. She was pretty conservative.
Was there any hot-button issue in particular that resonated with her? He leaned back in his chair, then brought it back down. I wouldn't exactly call it a hot-button issue, but Ellen felt strongly about agriculture. She grew up on a ranch in Wisconsin in the 60s. I think they sold mostly livestock, so she was always looking out for the farmers and ranchers. She pushed for more subsidized money from the state, better irrigation laws. She held a huge fundraiser every year that benefited the Washington Rancher Society, raised about $200,000 annually. I nodded, and I leaned back in my chair. What about men? What about them? Was Ellen seeing anyone? Any clandestine affairs? He shook his head. She didn't have the time. Hell, she couldn't make time for one man, let alone two. What about him? Adam? Yeah, Adam. She never mentioned anything, but I wouldn't put it past him. Neither would I, or had I. I asked, did she ever talk about her marriage? Every once in a while. Did she hate him? No. But she married him when she was too young, too naive. He leaned in and said she was divorcing him. Adam hadn't mentioned this. I gave Kim a quizzical look. He leaned even farther in and whispered, after she got elected this term, she was going to file. I knocked this around for a while. It would have been the perfect timing to file for divorce. She couldn't have filed while she was campaigning. No matter how strong her poll ratings were, a divorce would have ruined her. She might have carried the female vote, although she would have lost a substantial portion of even those. But the male vote would be irrevocably lost. I said, so she gets reelected and files for divorce. He nodded. When did she tell you this? Beginning of October, about 2 weeks before she disappeared. Do you know she had a prenup? I never asked her about it, but I would highly doubt it. When they got married, Gray was scraping to get by. He started amassing his fortune about the 6th year of their marriage. So she stood to take a pretty penny with her in the settlement. That would be an understatement. When's the last time you saw her? We did Sex in the City night the week before she disappeared. We were working our way through season 3. He started to get choked up and dabbed at his leaking eyes with his pink tie. I visualized Kim setting season 4 on her casket, still in the cellophane. He continued, I got a call early the morning of the 16th. Head of her security detail, Hank Proud, asked if I'd talked to her. I hadn't. She usually made a day out of hiking. She'd pack a lunch, get there early, and hike like 10 or 15 miles. But she was usually back in her car by 4 or 5, and she'd call Hank first off. He didn't start worrying until the following morning. When did he drive up there? He found her car around noon on Monday. His eyes started to water, and I had a feeling we were on the verge of some Niagara Falls-type weeping. Surprisingly, he fought back the currents and said, I knew right then that she was dead. So you think Adam had something to do with it? That's exactly what I think. Give me a scenario. He didn't hesitate. Adam gets wind that Ellen is going to divorce him. He knows she's hiking, away from her cell phone, away from her security detail. A better time to get rid of her. But he had an alibi. Yeah, I know. He's meeting with his client on his yacht. He rolled his eyes. Even so, he could easily have paid someone to do it for him. They didn't even have to kill her, just abduct her, and then he could do the rest. I shrugged with my mouth. I hadn't thought about this angle. Murder for hire. And Kim was right, they didn't even have to kill her. He was kidnapped for hire, which I'm sure with all the shady characters Gray knew, and the money in his bank account was not inconceivable. Shit. How many guys had Gray gotten off without a hitch? He could have just called in a marker. But my instincts told me Gray was hands-on. He didn't outsource anything. Didn't have any paralegals. He was a loner. If he killed his wife, he did it alone. And he did it with his bare hands. I asked, what about the new governor? Bill Eggers? Yeah. Well, he was the Democrat running against Ellen. He laughed to himself and said, Ellen had been missing for nearly 3 weeks, you know, before the November elections, and she still carried over 60% of the vote. He lost despite her being presumed dead? He nodded. Why was her name still on the ballot? Most people vote by mail these days, so they'd already mailed out all those. Plus, it would have been impossible to reprint all the ballots in such a small time span. He looked at me like I should know these things. Unfortunately, I'd never voted. I came close once. I had this one girlfriend who liked to do, well, it, in some rather odd places. I remember her wanting to vote for some Republican guy. I voted, she stopped voting and take her shirt off.
I campaigned one out. I asked, and then what?
Something like this had never happened before, so the state legislature put it to a vote. They could either leave Ellen's cabinet in place and let the vice governor take over, or by default they could usher Bill and his people in. They voted to leave Ellen's cabinet in place until the first of the year, but when her body was found, the legislature took a revote and ushered in Bill and his people.
Think he had anything to do with it?
He shook his head.
Doubt it.
He had a speaking engagement in Tacoma the day she went missing.
I nodded.
We chatted for another couple minutes, then I asked, is there anybody else that might know anything? Anybody else I should talk to? He tilted his head back and said, the nanny?